Good morning, campers. Thank you for tuning into our show. Actually, it's afternoon, but thank you for tuning in. We, Bo and I, Down and Dirty with Bo and Vic, are happy to be here today. And we have a very, very special guest that's dear to both of our hearts that we are going to be bringing on. In the meantime,
let's do a little housekeeping.
Join us on our Facebook page, Down and Dirty with Bo and Vic, and we post all of our articles, all of our links to our podcasts on our Facebook page, and that's easy access. And our show is every other Sunday at 4 o'clock Central Time. Then you have to adjust for your time zone. And you can go directly to our live shows at that time. And we want to introduce Ian Saxon, who lives in Wales. And he has an incredible story, really his whole life story, on how he has reforested or rewilded 7 acres of property in Wales. So I am going to hand this over to Bo to do a little introduction on how she came to know Ian, and we will go from there.
Well, an introduction on how I got to know Ian. Actually, it was on a dating site, and something I swore I'd never do, but I did, with some parameters. It had to be a spiritual and nature-oriented website, which it was, and that's how I met Ian. And then I was fortunate enough to go to live on his land for most of 2016, but before that he came to America. And funny story, we were talking about this the other day. We were driving from the Oregon coast to Boise, where I used to live. That's how I know Vicky. And he goes, "Whoa, look at that train." And I'm going, "What about it?" Because it was so long. You know, they don't have long trains in the UK. Anyway, his property is a wonderful, magical, so inspiring property. And we're interviewing him today because he's basically taken a piece of sheep grazing land and turned it into a mystical property with fairies and all kinds of elementals, birds, and the trees that he's grown. And so we're just going to ask him a few questions today. How did you get started, Ian? What inspired you to take this land and make it into what it is today?
Well, hello first. This is kind of something that's been with me since my childhood. I was always aware of nature. I was brought up with nature around me, and that was always the most important thing in my life. I remember as a child when lots of kids, if you ask them what they wanted to do when they grow up, they want to be a fireman, a doctor, or whatever, footballer. I said I want to live in a cabin on the side of a mountain by a stream, which is kind of what I did. So I went through my early teens living in various different communities, mostly in Wales. But back in that day, we didn't have the word permaculture. We didn't have the word sustainability. We didn't have the word rewilding. But that was happening. One of the places I was at for a while, which was the Tipi village in southwest Wales, large area of land where it had just been left, mostly just left, to to go back to nature. And that was rewilding without a word, without the word. So I wanted to create somewhere where nature could take over, where it wasn't controlled, it didn't have stock on it, it didn't have fences on it. So whilst looking for a parcel of the land, I happened to come into a small amount of money, which allowed me to buy a property in Wales, only about an acre of land, but enough to start playing with. The land that surrounded the cottage was originally a parcel of land that originally went with the cottage, with a river boundary around it, but it had long since been split up and sold. So I was able to buy that back again and get that seven acres back into the possession of that cottage and that little small holding. So this was after 13 years of living in the cottage that the land came up. I knew the farmer wanted me to have it. We came to a good agreement. So the 13 years I'd been walking around that land, dreaming it, I'd visualized everything I wanted to do with it, not knowing that I would ever actually have that land. But I dreamt it and I kept dreaming it. Every day I'd be out and I would walk the perimeter of it and I would look and I'd know what trees I was going to put where. Everything I knew. Anyway, magically, the land did come up for sale and I was able to get it. So as soon as I got it, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it and where I wanted to do it. So the first thing was in the Riverfield flat, which is the main flat piece of land bordering the river. I was able to put nice big vegetable garden down there, polytunnels, etc., get that started. And then the work of planting came along. I planted somewhere in over 2,000 trees, largely grown by myself or collected from stands of wild trees where there was too many to grow and they needed thinning out. I also did a lot of direct seeding, which is actually one of the fastest ways you can grow a woodland, because many people buy, you know, saplings, plant them, protect them, etc., etc. Whereas I can go out with a handful of acorns or a handful of hazelnuts or any other seeds and go around and plant them, which costs me nothing, and I can plant twice as many as what I need to grow. Some are going to get eaten, some are going to get rotted, but a large amount will make it, and those will grow faster than any sapling that you plant, because they've not had the roots disturbed at all. So that's what I started off doing. In the meantime, I was working in local forestry, a large private estate nearby, Powers Estates. They have lots of woodland. So I did a lot of work in there and learned a lot there. But at the same time, I was always into coppicing, which is a tradition that we've had in these parts of the world since the beginning of time, nearly. And it's basically using the woodland in a sustainable way, using the wood in a sustainable way. So you never or rarely actually, you don't, modern forestry in this country since the war, when we suddenly realized we hardly had any trees, they started planting forestry everywhere to make up for what we didn't have. But what they did was monoculture, spruce and pine, which, you know, in your country is native and looks great. In this country, it's almost a blot on the landscape. It's completely unnatural in this land, apart from in Scotland, where you have Scots pine forest, traditional. Now, coppicing is a tradition that we've had, which is where you're farming wood from the land, but you never take it all. You only take small amounts of it in a particular manner. So the basis of coppicing is you've got a small tree, 8-10 inches, something like that, across. You cut that off close to the ground. You'll get shoots come up all the way around it. You leave those shoots to grow. You'll end up with very long, very straight pieces of thin timber. After 7 years to 14 years, depending what you want, you can crop that timber again. Now, in the beginning years, what you're going to get is lots of long straight bits of wood, which you're then going to be using to be making wattle fences, you know, where you've got uprights and then you've got the other wood, the other sticks weaved in between. So you create a panel. Bigger wood you would split and make hurdles with, which is a similar thing but in larger scale. So all of those would have been used for, we had no metal fencing. So to keep livestock in, you had to have hurdles and such like. So those were all made in the woodland. Also out in the woodland, you would be making things like wooden rakes. Lots of furniture was made in within the woodland. A lot of it would have been using an ash pole lathe, which is a long length of fresh green ash, which is very bendy. The lathe itself is made out of wood. It's a very simple lathe with a treadle at the bottom and a rope going up to the ash pole. And pushing on the treadle, the ash pole comes down, pulls it back up again. Hey presto, you have a wood lathe. So a lot of the old furniture you would find in houses around here with turned wooden legs, those would all be done in the woodland. The guys that worked in the woodland would live in the woodland while they were doing this, producing all these different goods. One of the end products, after you've made all the tools, after you've taken material for fencing, etc., 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 the stuff that's left at the end would then be gathered and put together cleverly in a large pile, a very large pile, maybe 10 foot across, 4 foot high, something like that, all made up of the smaller sticks. Those would all be burnt, but before they're burnt, the soil would be drawn up around the wood so that you excluded oxygen, or bar a little bit at the top. You get that fire burning and then eventually you block the oxygen off completely. So the wood basically combusts. It doesn't burn and disappear and down to an ash. What you get left of it, of course, is charcoal. So then the charcoal would then be sold locally for what people used for cooking, etc. What else can I say? Obviously, there was food came from there as well, because a lot of these woods would be planted with, I don't know if you do you have hazel over there?
We do, but not, I don't know if there's maybe in the Appalachians it might grow wild,
That's what I thought
but doesn't in the
down there,
western,
maybe.
yeah,
Yeah,
it
yeah,
doesn't
yeah,
in the
yeah.
western states.
So I remember having Native American teachers come here many, many, many years ago. They were doing a sweat lodge, and they are absolutely amazed with the hazel, because the bendability of the hazel, you can bend it into all sorts of different shapes. Traditionally, gypsies used it over here to make a what we call a bender, which is like a tunnel, if you like, made out of hazel.
The shelter, isn't it?
It's a shelter, but they got glorified into some incredible structures, especially in the 1970s with the whole teepee kind of movement and the festivals. People were making benders, but these were some beautiful benders with porches, separate rooms going off them, lovely, lovely carpets on the floor, wood burner, all covered in tarps, but fantastic. People were living in them, still do in some places. So anyway, the guys in the woodland would move into the woodlands and live in the woodland whilst they were doing the work. They would often make a bender, and it would be covered with sod, just to make a temporary home. And then when they had cleared an area, an acre or so of woodland, now they would take all the small stuff that would be coppiced low to the ground, and then that would grow up again. 7, 14 years, they'd come back, cut it down, up, it would grow again. In between that, you would have mature trees that would be left. Some would be shaped and used for ships. Others would be shaped and used for A-frame traditional oak buildings, houses. So you never clear felled a woodland, which is modern woodland practice over here. Grow a woodland, fell it, and replant it, and you just destroy all the wildlife, everything that's there.
Right.
So that is
Lots of
changing.
that going on in the US right now. especially where I live. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clear cutting. Well,
they're changing over here in that what they've realized is that what they're trying to bring back is broadleaf trees again. So over here, if you take a spruce woodland and you clear fell it, 2-3 years, you come back and you won't recognize it. First couple of years, it'll be foxgloves and all sorts of wild perennials coming up. Within 2 or 3 years, you've got willow, ash, hazel, all the what we call the weed. Some people call them weed species. What's the word for it? Anyway, yeah, those are the first trees that come up. And within no time, 10, 15 years, you've got a thicket of woodland. There's no mature trees in there, but give it time. The mature trees will shade out the other trees, and then the oaks and the birches and the other slower, harder woods will start coming through. And the woodland will regenerate on its own naturally if you leave it. For many years, they were cutting down woodlands and then replanting with hardwoods. You know, if you want a wild woodland, you really don't need to replant. You just leave it. Cut it down and leave it and watch it do its thing. It's a magical process that happens, or at least here, because it's very wet.
There's a lot of, you mentioned plantation forestry. There's a lot of that here too. They'll clear cut a land, and and the company that does it says, oh, but we're replanting. Well, they replant all the same species.
Yeah.
And I don't know about there, because I haven't been to the UK in what, 9 years, but especially in Idaho and Eastern Oregon and Washington and into Montana, when they plant the same species, they seem more prone to either an infestation from pests or diseases, and then they start dying off. Yeah. So that a natural forest where you have all the different species, and Vicky and I have talked about, you know, what you see on the surface, but underneath the ground with the mycelium and you know, the mushrooms and all that, that there are places here that are rewilding or reforesting. And I think, pun intended, I think that movement is growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sorry for interrupting. Keep going.
Yeah, I mean, we hope that movement is growing all over the world, really. It is.
Yeah.
If you look about, it is happening. It's slow to start, but it is happening, yeah. I planted over 2,000 trees on this land, and I've already coppiced lots of it. So I've got mature trees getting bigger. I've got lots of hazel and ash. There's shoots all over the place, which I cut for all sorts of different things, for fences, for bean poles, for pea sticks. And of course, I supply all my own firewood off of that. So I'm allegedly carbon neutral. We have our own water. I've got two springs here, one of which had been closed for many years, but I reopened when I got the land. But they only last till April, May, if we're lucky. And then they're dry till November. So eventually, after years and years of just using rainwater in the summer or river water, then we eventually got a borehole. Very, very clean water, very, very good, endless supply, very happy with that. But I never abuse it. I never use it you know, it's a resource that you've really got to respect. Living without water in the summer for so many years gave me so much respect for it. Every little drop was important, you know. Water's sacred, and to be treated like that, just because it comes out of a tap doesn't mean to say that it's not sacred.
Right.
So we have the water, we have the firewood, we've got the vegetable garden, we've got fruit trees and bushes, etc. There was a period where I was hunting with my Harris hawk as well, because we get a lot of pheasant on the land. So there was a period when I was hunting pheasant and going down that route a bit.
Would you like to talk a little bit more about we call it falconry in this country? And you're and you're
Okay.
and also re restoring injured birds. That's
Yeah,
really
okay.
interesting.
Yeah. So with the birds, I always had a fascination. I remember seeing my first buzzard when I was about 8, 9 years old down in the south, down in Devon, on a gatepost as we drove past. And then they were an endangered species here because birds of prey had been almost wiped out, decimated by DDT being put on the land, which in turn made killed everything and killed the mice. The mice would eat it, the birds would eat the mice, the birds would die. So it's been a long haul to get birds of prey back up in this country, but it's been a real success story with, I mean, buzzards now, they're no longer protected, they're just everywhere. Red kites, they were over, and there was just a, I mean, literally a dozens of pairs left in Wales. That was it. They'd just been wiped out. Now you see them every day, everywhere you go. They're everywhere because of feeding stations and protection. And people have learned respect for them now. Whereas one time they were just seen as vermin. Now people love to see them. So I had that fascination always from a child. And then one time, a long time ago, I was down, not feeling good, and I was just trying to bring myself out of that. Well, I happened to go see an advert for a falconry centre, which I went to, met some of the guys there, got chatting, and was surprised at how much I could actually do if I wanted to. So I went along there and started having some. I started an apprenticeship there, learning falconry. I did that for a while, then I went to some other people who had a very different approach to falconry, a non-hunting approach. They were more doing rehabbing and shows, but I got a lot of information, a lot of knowledge from that. I had lots of reservations about it because I do not like restriction of animals. And also not very keen on the food source, which most of them were feeding them, which is dead day old chicks. But they're kind of seen as a byproduct of the chicken industry. And if falconers and people didn't have them, then they would just be burnt or ploughed into the ground. So it's kind of a pretty unpleasant, unfortunate byproduct. Those things put me off completely. And I just, the desire is so deep in me to be around those birds, but I don't want to go down that road. So I gave it all up, forgot about it, thought, no, I'm just going to let go of this. And then I walked down my river field and I found a buzzard with all his feathers broken off. But, okay. So it starts here. So I brought that up. So I've got to go and get some dead day old chicks now. And I've got to build an aviary and I've got to start putting into practice what I've learned with this bird. I knew she was a youngish bird and she had obviously been not fed well. All the feathers were broken. So malnutrition, calcium deficiency, stuff like that. And that was my first bird, Mystic. And that was my first bird that I learned so much on. The more time I spent with her and the more involved I got, the more birds started to just appear. People would bring them to
Magically.
me, I would find them. Yeah, you know, every time you have that dream and you put your intent into that, your
Yes.
focus into that, it's incredible what turns up. Lately, I've stopped doing it in later years, and I have to really not think about it because if I think about it, I thought about it the other day and an owl turned up. So, so then I got all sorts of birds coming to me, and then the local vet would ring me on a fairly regular basis and say, "Hey, we got this bird here. Could you come and have a look?" So. Many times when you get them, you just have to say no, you can't do anything with it. It's too far gone, or it's too injured to keep in captivity. It's a wild bird. It wouldn't be fair to the bird, and they have to be euthanized. But for all of those that didn't make it, there were lots and lots and lots that did make it that I got back to the wild, which is just such a wonderful experience. I can think of a female peregrine falcon I had, beautiful big girl, and when I got her, she would stand on your wrist, which a wild bird just should not do. That wild bird should be flapping and flying away from you. So she had a respiratory infection, and she had ticks all around her neck, and she was very malnourished. So we treated her for the with antibiotics for the respiratory infection, got rid of the ticks, etc., etc. Got her fed up well, and she came on very, very nicely, to the point when she was ready to start battering herself around the aviary. So you only have a small aviary, so they can't injure themselves. So that's time. She's ready. She's got to go. So I took her. I knew roughly where she'd come from, and I looked on the map was into that area, and I could see this big rocky escarpment, and I thought, that'll be it, that's peregrine territory, that's where they hunt from, you know. So yeah, I drove over there, found this place over the other side of the valley, and we looked over, and you could see the rocky escarpment over there. Took her out, and the local farmer and partner came out, and they were kind of alternative farmers, you know, from the 70s that came up, so they were cool, and they were really happy to see what we were doing. And they knew of the peregrines because they were there. They watched them. They were aware they were there. Anyway, we released this bird. She plumped straight over the valley, straight over to the rocky escarpment. Short while later, I got an email from them saying that they've seen her with her partner, and they've been flying over the garden. And it's great. She's back. Months after that, I got another email from them saying she's back again, and she's brought all of her youngsters with her.
Oh, what a great story.
That's yeah. Sweet. Very
yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, so lots of stuff. I also did a lot with crows. Crows are just like so dear to my heart. I just love all the corvids, all of them. They're so intelligent, so wise, so clever, and so mischievous.
Mischievous.
As well.
Tika.
Yes.
Tika.
Yeah. The last one I had was Fifi, and she was a big crow. And I also had my Harris hawk at the time. The Harris hawk wasn't a rescue bird. That was a bird from someone that has a pair that hunt all winter, and then he breeds them in the summer. So I had a youngster off of him. So my Harris hawk, I flew every day along with the other different birds. But no, the funny story was with the crow that I had, Fifi, my Harris hawk, Talon, used to see us feeding Fifi, the baby, from a baby. So, I mean, naturally, a Harris hawk should take a crow, no problem. But because he had watched her grow up with us, he had accepted her as part of our tribe. Part of our group. I'm sure you know Harris hawks hunt in a pack. They're one of the few birds that only one out of two lots of birds in the world actually fly in a pack. Harris hawks is the one. So anyway, I'd have my Harris hawk on the perch in the garden, and Fifi the crow, she would fly past the Harris hawk within inches of him just to annoy him. And he'd kind of lift his wing like that, but never once did he attack her because he knew she was part of our group. Yeah.
And so oh my god,
she's gone wild now. She went yeah, with it. She met up with a load of other wild crows, and she came to say goodbye, gave me a good rub all around my neck. And yeah, beautiful birds, lovely birds, so understood corvids. Mm-hmm. You know, so many people just disregard them. People look at birds of prey and they're majestic and powerful, and look at the crows.
The crows and the ravens,
all the corvids.
Yes.
The whole range, yeah.
They're
the whole range.
So smart.
They have their own language. I mean, ravens, they've identified over 50 odd different separate individual words that they use. Mm-hmm. They have their own language. So yeah, I'm a big supporter of crows.
I have a family of four crows living here, and I thought that they were roosting in my huge pine tree out front, because they hung out there all April, just thick as thieves. And I never could find a nest, but Then they've migrated to the back area, and I've got a lot of trees that they must be roosting in. And then I have this gigantic cherry tree in my backyard, and they are in heaven. They're chasing the squirrels away. And oftentimes I look out my back and all four of them are sitting on the fence, and they're so entertaining. And I mean, I know that you can get friendly with them, but I've never done that. But I get very annoyed when they're all just going off for hours at a time. It's like there's no peace and quiet. But then they were doing a big mate. I think they were doing a big mating ritual at one point, because they were making the weirdest sounds together and hopping over one another. And so I'm going, okay, you guys go ahead and do what you're doing, you know. But they're still here. They're still
Crow
here. Thing.
business, that is.
Yes.
Yeah.
They have a lot of that.
I have where I live, I have crows. I always talk to them. There's bald eagles, there's red-tail hawks. The other day, I'm house sitting at my sister's, and I'm pretty sure some prairie falcons were chasing. It was a bigger bird. It wasn't a raven. Well, it could have been, I don't know. But they were chasing them. They were making the most racket, but they chase them away from their nest because corvids are very sneaky and they like to eat eggs.
I remember my Fifi, my crow. She had there was a sparrowhawk flying over, and if you get them, but she hated anyone coming into her airspace. Birds of prey she really hated, and if I could have filmed her, it would have been hilarious. She was flying above this sparrow hawk, diving down, shouting at it, trying to kick it. She was relentless, and it could have turned around and had her, but she was too much fun, you know. By the
Nice.
way, that's something I need to mention is when I talk about buzzards, I'm not talking about vultures. I'm talking about red tails, okay? So
Yes.
our buzzards are what you call red tails,
Right. Right.
okay?
Yes.
Only ours don't have red tails, and they're a bit smaller.
Ah.
Right.
They're
Yeah.
brown tails.
Nice.
Can I ask you to tell a funny story about when you first got your land and you were reforesting it and you had a polytunnel full of maple
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I did. So amongst the other things I did with the land, I used the polytunnels down in the river field to grow plants to sell. I used to do 20,000 laurel cuttings a year, which went off to a big local nursery, and I did sell vegetables from there as well at some points, but it was always more always made more money on shrubs and trees. And the other thing I did was Japanese maples. I fell in love with Japanese maples, so I literally had thousands, which I sold just privately, you know, at different events and stuff, and people knew I had them. Oh, consequently, my land is covered in Japanese maples, so very colourful in the autumn. So yeah, I had one tunnel full of Japanese maples, and one day there was a knock at the door, and I opened the door, and it's the local police with a warrant to search the premises. I'm like, okay. And I'm doing what? And they wouldn't tell me, but they kept searching. And I'm like, why are you doing? You know, really? Anyway, shortly after, this other policeman came to the door with a big torch. And well, Izzy had obviously just come up from the river field, looked at the other guys, so they looked excitedly at him, and he said, "There's nothing there, no." And I thought, and that's when I said, "Oh, I get you. You think I had a polytunnel full of cannabis plants? Well, it's Japanese maples." So
Fun.
we all had a good laugh, and I said, "Well, fair play. They do kind of look a bit like that, you know.
They do.
Someone must have seen them sticking through the polythene somewhere, and I don't know where because we're pretty remote. But someone must have seen them and reported them. So,
Well, you do
yeah,
have the
that's
road
the.
there out on the other side of the river. Maybe somebody, a nosy somebody, saw them and
It's so
reported it.
many trees, so many trees you can't see across. It, I don't know. Who knows? Anyway.
That's
I always thought
funny.
that was a funny story.
Can for our audience, who a lot are here in the US, could you describe what a polytunnel is? Because I'll bet you, just like a lot of people didn't know what coppicing was, I have a feeling some people don't know what a polytunnel is.
Okay, so polytunnel, I'm sure plenty of people do know in America what polytunnels are, but it's basically U-shaped hoops stuck in the ground with polythene over the top. So it's like a glorified cold frame or cloche that you can walk into. It's a greenhouse. It's a big greenhouse covered in polythene. It's a way of having a greenhouse that's cheap to build, and cover a lot of space quickly. Yeah, and extremely efficient and extremely necessary, particularly in this climate here, because we get late frost in the spring and early frost in the autumn. So you have a short season. Like when I first came to Bowes in Boise, and I was there in what, October, November, and they're cropping peppers from the garden. Well, we can't even grow peppers in the garden, let alone crop them in October, November. Everything like that has to be in a tunnel here. Just to keep the frost out, yeah. But
Well,
yeah.
I have a tunnel. One, I've got three big rows of, row plants, and I have one tunnel, but it's covered in row cloth, the permeate, not plastic. It's that row cloth. And I keep all of my greens going all summer, where they'd all be bolting and dead by pretty much by the end of June because of the heat. But I keep the hard sun off of them, and I've got my kale, my chard, my spinach, and my cilantro all summer long. So they're wonderful, wonderful things to have in your garden to either make the season longer or keep the greens and things that are so heat sensitive alive all summer.
So
That's
the polytunnels that Ian, well, he only had one when I was there, but it's almost like a Quonset hut. So you could walk in, and it had beds in there.
Nice.
So really nice. And
Nice.
then I was wondering, how you were talking, Ian, about the woodsmen with their lathes to work the. Are people still doing that? Is that, or is
There
that
are the
more like
yeah
done on a
there are
museum?
there are people still doing it up until probably 30 years ago, maybe a little bit more. It literally, it pretty much been resigned to just museums, but there was the last few people still making stuff, countrymen that still had the knowledge and still had the craft. Well, then particularly in the 70s and 80s, with the resurgence of interest in and all that kind of stuff, people started to relearn all of those skills, which they have
Nice.
now, and it is now a living, breathing thing. It tends to be more at, fairs and things like that. I mean, farmers aren't using wattle fences to keep their sheep in anymore. It's all fence, metal fencing or hedging, but they are still used. Yeah, lots of people have regained those skills. Yeah, it's a country craft that people have now kept alive. And if you go into craft markets and stuff like that, then people will sell a lot of those items. I did lots of. I've got not on a ash pole lathe, but I made most of my own wooden bowls and plates and all sorts of stuff like that.
Nice. Sometimes I geek out on YouTube videos that are about permaculture and regenerative farming and something new to me. I actually wrote an article for BBS and Solar Punk, and people are going back to the old ways on their property and doing a lot what you've been doing for years, Ian. And I feel like one of the reasons Vicky and I started this channel was because
we have some experience and wisdom in a lot of the old ways. I mean, think simple things like canning. A lot of, but we talked about it in our permaculture, our last show about permaculture, how people are so dependent on going to the grocery store for everything. And that's really a sad state of affairs. It's unsustainable. And, it's one of the things I loved about your property is you had the garden, you reforested the woods, you had fairies because I saw them, and just being with the land. I've been a back to the lander person since I was a teenager too, and I grew up loving nature, and I know Vicky did too. So,
It brings you spiritually, it brings you completely in touch. When you're not doing that, it's so easy to not be in touch with the seasons, to not be in touch with the rhythms of the earth. When you're out there and everything depends on what the weather's going to be like. Everything depends on what the season's going to be like. And here the seasons vary dramatically from year to year. So you really have to be prepared for anything. But you've constantly got yourself focused on what the land is doing, what's growing, what isn't growing, what's been a good year, what's been not such a good year. So you're just in touch with the natural cycles and patterns of nature on a daily basis.
I am.
Earth, air, fire, and water. So many children these days, they just don't know this.
They don't know.
In fact, a little story. I got a stepdaughter here who hadn't lived anywhere like this here before, but now she does. And one day she'll laugh if she knows I'm telling this story. One day I was trying to teach her how to light the, because I've got an outhouse that I built out there, wooden, and she had moved into that, and the heating is a wood burner. So I had to teach her how to light a fire. And she was being a little bit about it, and I asked her why. She said, "Well, I don't think it's really important to us these days about how to light a fire because we don't need that anymore. We've got other ways of doing it." Oh, God, I was peeved. I huffed and puffed for quite a while, but anyway. Cut a long story short, this came back to bite her because she did learn how to light a fire. She did learn what dry wood was, what dead was, what wood was, what green wood was, so what to use, when to use it, and how to use it. And then she ended up in various situations away with friends in cabins and alternative structures and stuff where all they had was a wood burner. And of course, her friends were trying to light this fire, and they were using green wood, wet wood. And so Jasmine was able to say, "I think we need some better wood than that." And she knew how to light a fire. And she put that into practice time after time after time.
Nice.
And she's come back and said, "Yeah, okay, you were right. Yeah.
And she impressed her friends, right?
Absolutely, yeah." And this is
I
what
have a.
they all need this earth, air, fire, and water. They all need to know about it.
Yes.
It's the most important thing. Living in a
Yes.
city, where you're just out of touch with nature completely, how can you expect people to be normal, to be in tune, in that? Everything around you is false. Everything.
It is, and I feel that humans were meant to live like that, in touch with nature,
Of
and
course.
it is,
We are
it's a di
part of nature. That's the whole
exactly,
thing. We
exactly. There's
forget
no
we put
separation.
ourselves separate. We're not a separate thing. We're dependent on it and we interact with it. It's who and
Yes.
what we are. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I have a funny story about making a fire. Years ago, I took a course in horticulture class. It was called Edible, Medicinal, and Poisonous Plants of Southern California. And in this class, it was, all adults. We were all in college. I was actually in my 40s when I took it. And we had three field trips where we would go camping. We went to the mountains, to the chaparral, which is there's not chaparral a lot of places. It's kind of like a prairie, but it's not.
I
And
know.
then we went to the desert, and we went to Joshua Tree Park, and our teacher would take us around and tell us what all the plants were and what their uses were, or if they were poisonous. And the first night there, the guys in the class were trying to start a campfire, and nobody could get it started. So I said, "I'll do it." So I put the wood as you're supposed to, and the kindling and the whole nine. And my teacher at the time, Dr. Horn, loved the man, said, "Wait, wait, wait. I want to get this on film." So he brings out this camcorder that's probably 3 feet long, and he's recording it. That's how long ago that was. But the guys are all going, "Wow, how did you learn how to do that?" And my parents taught me, and that's one thing is teaching the children, like you did with your stepdaughter, Ian. It's so important. And then some kids just have no interests. Like, I don't think my daughter can start a fire, but
I
I'm
mean,
willing to teach her.
you take a little kid and show them, you take them out on the land and you show them a fire and show me one kid that's not interested.
Oh yeah.
Ah, oh, it's
You
the
know?
best. Yes.
Yeah, and it's like, but it's dangerous, so we mustn't let them near it. It's like at the moment in this country, if you've got a knife in your pocket, is an epidemic of knife violence in this culture. We've got knife violence rather than gun violence. But when we were kids, every kid I knew carried a knife. We all carried a knife. Everyone had a pen
Yes.
knife and a load of
Yeah.
string.
Yeah.
It's your
Yeah.
basic stuff. These days, they don't
I've been
know about
carrying one.
carrying knives. They only know about carrying knives for violence. They don't know
Right.
about carrying knives for all those other purposes
Right.
because they
And
don't know where to
what
use them.
perpetuates the violence is that it's always in the mainstream media, it's in people's faces. I've been carrying a knife since I was a kid too. Yeah, they come quite in handy.
Very
They do.
handy. Once I was going through TSA, I was in Colorado and I was coming home to Boise. And when I went, I had the best Swiss knife. I'd had it for years. I put it in my luggage. And then when I got there, put it in my purse, and I forgot to take it out, and they confiscated. I was so peeved. I was so pissed off. Yeah.
Somebody got to keep a nice knife, but anyway. Do you have any questions, Vicky?
Not really. I was going to offer when I was down in my kids' place this weekend, about the harvest and being in tune with the seasons. A few things came up, and Jay and Amy are my kids, and they live on 2 acres, and they have so many different kinds of perennial food plants. And the Nanking cherries were ripe, so my daughter and I went out and picked Nanking cherries, and within 4 hours we had 5 quarts of Nanking cherry juice steamed. And I was just thinking of how instantaneous, it's literally liquid sunshine. Here are these beautiful, beautiful berries ready. And now we've got a few quarts of this liquid sunshine, and it's just divine. And yesterday when I got home, the service berry tree right next door in Marsgar, my dehydrator's full of service berries now, to go in granolas and just put on oatmeal or whatever, you do with them. And I love the analogy of just capturing the sunlight in the height of the when things are ripe. And that is literally eating that energy all throughout the year when you can capture it and preserve it. And that's what we're all interested in. You're creating this forest around you that's capturing all the biome of all of the critters that live there, all of the insects. And I was thinking when you're talking about and especially here in the US, when they just completely clear cut and then they go in and they plant these little sapling pine trees, it takes decades for that biome to regenerate,
A woodland
if
is an
ever.
it's an organism,
It's
and
a
you
whole
it's a whole
complete,
organism.
yes. And so if we can just get little parcels of land back to that, it's, I mean, I was sitting out yesterday with Ken in my backyard, and I've got these larkspur, these wild larkspur growing, and the bumblebees, I mean, there's a an inch and a half long, it's so big, it lands on a branch and it bends the branch over. It's such a huge, and it's just, I mean, I don't need to go anywhere else to enjoy the entertainment of these hungry insects just devouring the pollen in these flowers. It's so fun, you
How
know.
do you find the insect populations now?
There's almost no honeybees. There's a lot of bumblebees and some smaller, lots of pollinator bees. Most of the ones that I'm witnessing are ones that live in the ground. They don't have hives. So honeybees, I hardly see any anywhere.
Hardly see butterflies here. I saw a
I've seen
tiger swallowtail the other day, but they used to be
yeah.
thick.
Yeah.
Crickets, like it used to be able to fall asleep to crickets.
There's no crickets, none. And
It just makes me wonder. Like again, I say to my stepdaughter, it's like if you could have, if you could have seen when we were not that long ago, you went out for a drive in the car, and you came back, and the number plate in the windscreen was splattered with insects.
yeah.
If I
Yes.
sat here, I sit here with the summer's evening with the door wide open and the light on, the room would have been full of moths and all sorts of things.
Right.
Now I used to have to put screens up at the window at night with the window with the light on to
Right.
stop all the insects. I don't need them anymore. There's so
Yeah.
few insects.
No, it's.
And like the area that I'm living in, although it's mostly kind of sheep around here, a lot of them are organic, and the ones that aren't organic, they're not really using hardly anything other than a, you know, a bit of feed on the land, artificial, but they're not really doing anything different here that they've done for the last 50, 60, 70 years. So like in an area where they're growing crops and they're using you know, very toxic chemicals, insecticides and herbicides, I can understand that. But there's nothing like that around here, and yet the insects are still dying. And if that's happening, it's not coming from, it's coming from the atmosphere, isn't it? It's coming from
Do they
everywhere.
chemtrail in the UK? Yeah.
Well,
Huge.
people
We have
talk
about
about
three
them
minutes, guys, just to let you know.
there. Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's
It goes fast when you're having a great conversation. Yeah, I
yeah.
think it's a number of things. I think it is toxic in this country anyway, the chemicals that they use on the polyculture. But I think a great deal of it also is the chemtrails. It gets in the water, it gets in the soil. Plus, here they are knocking down forests and trees to build subdivisions for all the people that have moved here since 2020. I won't mention why, but I think we all understand what that means. And there's no place for the butterflies to, you know, where the caterpillars to make their cocoons. There's
On a
nothing to
positive
forage.
note, there's a place in the south of England called Knepp, NEP, Knepp Estate. I think it's NEP Estate. And it's big for this country. It's over 1,000 acres. And they've rewilded that, but they have livestock on there still, and they still farm the livestock. But they don't, the amount of input they used to have to put into the land in terms of fertilizers, chemicals, and stock, and everything that the stock needed. They worked out in the end it would be easier to let the whole lot go wild, still keep the stock on it. They still get to take stock off of it, but they don't have to work the land because the land does it itself if you find the right balance. And they have got in out in this country one of the biggest conservation projects go. It's not conservation really, because it's birds that weren't there, turtle doves, which have almost become extinct here. That's the only place in the country where they're starting to re-nest. Nightingales, all sorts of creatures that are disappearing everywhere else. They're expanding down there because
Yeah.
Because, 7 acres is good, 5 acres is good. I know lots of people with little areas of land, and if you put all those together, that's a lot of land. But you need it all joined up. That's what you need to get the real effect. There's a whole area towards West Wales they're now talking about rewilding. So farmers not
Nice.
but working.
Yeah, that like the what you were talking about, the Napa State, that's I think that's what they call regenerative farming, basically, where they it's like a symbiotic unit. So we're come to the end of our show, guys, and I'm popping this on Ian. Maybe we could have you on again as a guest, not necessarily right away. It's up to you, our schedules, but I think our audience is going to be fascinated. Also, if you have any questions for Ian, if you go to bbsradio.com/downanddirty and you go down, scroll down, there is an email that you can fill out. We will get this, and so we can put that on the agenda for next time. Any parting words for either of you?
It's fascinating, and it's so nice to reconnect with you and hear your story. And we're all interested in the same thing of regeneration and helping to educate people who really don't know a lot of this. They don't know how to garden. They don't know how to take care or be stewards of the land. So that's what Bo and I are really interested in. And you've been doing it all your life too. So it's really nice. Thank you so much.
One love.
One love. Love you both.
Love.
Thank you so much, Ian. Really
Okay.
appreciate you.